You are listening to the Regent College Podcast.
Hi, I'm Rachel Hanna.
And I'm Claire Perini.
And welcome to the Regent College Podcast.
Folks, we're inviting you to join us for our final conversation on the podcast for this year with Dr. Quinton Jenness. And if you've listened to the podcast for a little while, you'll know his name. If you've been around Regent in the last couple of years, you'll know his name. If you've worked on the downtown east side, you might know his name. If you've ever been to St. Paul's Hospital in the emergency room, you may know his name as well. We were having a conversation with him about his recent book called Recovering People and the class that he's teaching called Addiction in the Church. Quinton is a compassionate, thoughtful, winsome, humble, kind, intelligent person who thinks in ways I've never heard anyone talk about what it means to be a person and then how he understands that in relation to his work as an emergency physician. And you can't help but walk away feeling encouraged, convicted, and deeply assured that somehow the gospel that he's seeking to live is good news for people, and particularly people living with addiction, as he talks about it.
Yeah, he has this amazing capacity to tell stories that are so difficult, bringing out the beauty of common humanity in the midst of that, and really encouraging us as Christians to think through that in terms of how we relate to one another in the church and make the church a place where persons with addictions feel that there's belonging and there's hospitality and refuge. And I was really struck by what he said about the place of confession and just admitting our frailty and our need of God and also of each other.
Yeah. So Dr. Quinton Jenness is an emergency physician at St. Paul's Hospital here in Vancouver, and he's a scholar in residence at Regent. He holds a Master of Letters in Theology from the University of St. Andrews. And as I mentioned earlier, he's the author of a forthcoming book on addiction in the church called Recovering People. And then Quinton will be here with us at Regent teaching a class called Addiction and the Church from January 5th to 9th, 2026. So if you're thinking about what you might do in that first week of January, and if any of the things that we've talked about feel compelling or interesting to you, then join us. But in the meantime, enjoy our conversation with Dr. Quinton Jenness. Quinton, welcome back to the Regent Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming again. Now, last time we chatted, you were going on a big European adventure because you were actually taking some time off from the 8,000 things that you did. how was it?
It was awesome. So I took almost 6 weeks off of all of my jobs, and my family and I went to Europe, to France and Belgium and the Netherlands for one calendar month. And it was a good mix. We saw some of our very, very dear friends. And we also had lots of weeks of just our family and an old Volkswagen van and tootling around Normandy, eating crepes. And it was wonderful also to share with our children some of the things my wife and I love, history and going into old churches and looking at the paintings. And
yeah. How did they go with the old churches and the paintings? Did they love them as much as you do?
So it's funny, my daughter, who's in grade 3, had to do a project for school. It's called her Ignite Project, where she has to bring one of her personal passions, make a poster, and then do a presentation to the class. Right. And this year she chose to do her presentation on Adoration of the Mystic Lamb, which is also called the Ghent Altarpiece, which is one of the very famous, which I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with. So I'm not sure in terms of formation if she'll look back and roll her eyes at us trying to.
How old is she?
She's 8.
Whoa. Yeah.
Classic. Like every 8-year-old. Just like doing a reflection on that.
Yeah, we weren't sure if we were going to get any blowback from the school because, you know, and there's some Adam and Eve are nude in the painting, so we weren't sure how it would be received. But fortunately, we didn't receive any negative feedback. But it's great, actually, example with kids. Pieces of art like that have wonderful histories. It's been stolen 20 times. So some of the interest of the kids is in the story of the thing. And there's one of the panels, as you probably know, that was stolen. They've never found it. So there's still this ongoing mystery. So I actually felt like it was a good way that not our really young kids, but that at all of our different ages, we could share these experiences and there could be footholds for all of us to find points of interest. So yeah, I think that the kids did really well given their ages and they seem to have taken some edifying learning points as well about art and Christian history and those kinds of things.
So. Well, next time we chat, we should see like what's really sunk in, you know, like in a year's time, like are they, you know, is it, where's it, where's the interest in Christian history these days?
Yeah, exactly.
So J-term, you know, next month you're going to be teaching a course on addictions. We talked about this a little bit the last time we were together, but you've just released a book that you've written on addiction in the church called Recovering People.
Great title, by the way.
Yeah, a double meaning.
Yeah, I've got to mention, I have one of my dear friends, his name is John Bryars, who's a pastor at Christ City Church, which is the church that we go to. I have to credit John that he came up with this title because I'm terrible at naming things. So I want to be honest and say that the double meaning cool title is not the product of my mind, but John Bryars.
Yeah. So good.
So, yeah, you've taught classes here before. So how is this course going to be different from the other ones?
I'm really excited about this course, obviously, because this topic has been my deep dive in terms of research and intellectual interest over the past 2 years. The prior courses that I've taught at Regent, mainly the medical ethics course, are more survey style courses. Mm. There's so many good things about survey style courses. You can cover a lot of different things in a short period of time and really give persons footholds for further inquiry into a lot of areas. But there's limitations to those things as well. I often feel in teaching those, like, you're opening a box with so many interesting questions and then releasing the students to those questions without having as much time as any of us would like to really carefully churn them over. So this is more of a focused course on the subject of addiction that will not tie up every question about addiction in the whole world, but where we will have much more time than in other conversations to really carefully go through a variety of questions related to addiction. So I think that's the main difference from the other courses. And I think I'm really excited about this course because I think now is such a time where the church, Christian communities have really profound opportunities in our communities to be places of healing, recovery, and freedom for addiction, which is such a perplexing and challenging issue, which increasingly everyone acknowledges is such a challenge facing our civilization.
Yeah. And you describe it then as this kind of a crisis of our time in that sense. Yeah. Can you give us a few stats on addictions? How many people would you say are struggling with addictions of various kinds? And so obviously you're thinking about addictions in a much broader kind of sense. So various kinds, but also then what is feeling the most prevalent from what you've looked into?
I think when most people hear the word addiction, our minds often jump to the really obvious identifiable addictions. And I think the one that we see in the news all the time is addiction related to substances, and probably opioids is the most present in the news, especially for people who live in big cities like Vancouver. Although we know that opioid addiction causes tragic and devastating harm in rural communities as well. And this is another conversation, but many people think the origins of the opioid crisis started in more rural communities, at least the present opioid crisis we're in the midst of now. There's a whole bunch of statistics I could cite with respect to that particular addiction. One of the really striking ones that I read, this is a study that came out this year that said 1 in 3 American adults know someone who's died of an overdose. And if we just think again about this as a personal problem, the way the devastation of these deaths really obviously is the loss of an irreplaceable person who bore the image of God, but also the way it just fractures families and wounds communities. 1 in 3 American adults know someone who's died. If we just think of the cumulative effect that that has on communities as a whole. There's a whole bunch of other stats last year. The last year when there was data recorded, more than 81,000 American adults died of overdoses. Mm-hmm. British Columbia, just about 5 people every day die of overdoses. And that's opioids alone,
probably.
That's
just in BC.
So again, we don't want to be numbed by the numbers. Mm-hmm. Taking the careful time to think of each of those as persons. One of the biggest blessings of my vocation is knowing many of those people as persons, hearing their stories, you know, asking where they come from, seeing their senses of humor, all the things that that are more important than any statistic. And yet that same beauty of the value of each person should also give us a deepened sense of the tragedy that these again aren't just statistics, they're persons. And that's to speak only of opioids. And I think by any metrics that I'm aware of, some of these things are, of course, hard to measure, but other kinds of addictions are only increasing and the harms of them are increasing. So the prevalence of pornography addiction, some studies would estimate that most men in Canada and the United States have what you might call an addiction to pornography, which is staggering. And the increase of gambling addiction with online gambling and those things that are, again, harder to measure, harder to study, certainly are very common. They're common on this UBC campus that are common in art churches. One of the core contentions that I make in the book, which sounds simple, but I think is important to say, is that addiction, although it's difficult to precisely define, addiction is harmful to human persons, that we were made with a nature given by God not to be trapped in patterns of compulsive behavior that undermine our attempts to pursue the good things in life. And so in the more dramatic addictions that produce headlines, in the maybe less visible dramatic addictions, these are things that run against the freedom that God made us for. And as a result, this issue deserves the careful attention of Christian persons and communities.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of what's fueling the kind of the prevalence, either socially and personally, the online thing, I guess you said, with pornography and then gambling, like that came, that's, I guess, maybe a part of it. But
I think that there are a number of avenues you could approach this question from. I think one thing that I would want to emphasize is that I believe one of the first things we should see about addiction is that for many people, maybe not all people, addictions are ways of looking for the good things in life. They're ways of looking for meaning, peace, belonging, purpose, joy, acceptance, healing. However fruitless they may be at producing those good things, the power of addiction is in their continual ability to offer those things. Mm. And I've found this, one of the things that I've tried to do in my practice and seeing patients that have severe addiction is to, in a context of having established trust with the patient, to just ask them the why question. And again, not in a judgmental or unkind way, but to ask them, why do you use fentanyl? What are you seeking? The thing that I continually find is that people describe what they look for in their addictive object in sort of moral terms, in terms of meaning. Mm. People say fentanyl feels like someone wrapping their arms around you, or it feels like someone pulling a blanket over you while you're falling asleep. It feels like a hug. It feels like someone giving you a hot drink when you're out in the cold. These are terms that evoke. Right. And this is why the language of recreational drug use makes me upset in its shallow look at persons. Yeah. They're not looking for recreation in a shallow sense. They're looking for deeper things that actually all of us need. A patient recently said to me, this guy I was chatting to, he knows that I'm a person of faith. And he said, you don't understand. Smoking fentanyl feels like God is in your lungs.
Wow.
And again, we should be, if we believe that these are our neighbors, they're persons, they have a nature like us, we should be really attentive to these kinds of explanations. Of course, that doesn't explain all the causation of how many people develop addiction. But I do think that when we look at a social, societal level and say, why are addictions so increasingly prevalent? I do think that we live in a time in a civilization that has a absence of meaning. Many people go through lives, our context often, in the way that it's individualistic, it's consumeristic, it doesn't provide persons with thick spaces to search for the things that all of us want and need. And as a result, it's not surprising that people are increasingly drawn to unhelpful attachments that don't produce the goods of life. So I would want to say addiction is one face of the common human project of looking for the things that we were made for. Mm-hmm. The reason why addiction is so tragic is because it doesn't work. It's fruitless. This, Augustine is a big influence on my thought. He describes that God-shaped hole, right?
Yeah.
You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And Augustine, of course, famously looked for the goods of life in all the wrong places before he met the Lord. And he was so good at seeing underneath those fruitless avenues was my genuine searching for God. I really was groping after God.
And
I think that viewing the addiction crisis through a charitable and a personal lens helps us see so many people in our society are looking for meaning. They're looking for the things that can be found in right relationship with God. And at present, many of us are looking for those things in the wrong places. I think that's a fruitful avenue of thinking about this. I also think it's a hopeful avenue of thinking about about this crisis, I do think crisis is the right language. I don't want to be an alarmist kind of person, but again, thinking narrowly about opioids and broadly about the phenomenon of addiction, it's a heavy moral problem because the affected persons matter so much. But because it involves persons who were made for friendship with God, there's reason for hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. In your book, you know, you're going into some detail about
the perceptions and framings of addiction, and you talk about the choice model and the disease model. So could you explain that a bit for people who maybe haven't heard of those concepts and the implications of the different ways of looking at it?
For sure. I think we can say as a headline that human behavior is sometimes perplexing. Addictive.
Oh, really?
Yeah, exactly.
Not just in this way. Oh, yeah. Okay, right. Yeah. It's a more broad thing, right.
And we look at all of ourselves, right? Like, I think anyone who's trying to live the examined life, we look back at our day and we say, I don't know why I did that. I don't know why I said that. And one of the wonderful things in thinking about this book is realizing that truth is evidenced in the Bible. I think most precisely St. Paul says in Romans, you know, I do the things I don't want to do. Yet the things I really want to do, I find myself not doing. And he looks internally. And I know people, the biblical scholars, I'm not a biblical scholar, but they will, you know, there's some debate of when Paul was writing that. But Paul still reveals us to ourselves, I think, there, that we have these mixed up. There's sometimes this inability to connect what we really want to how we behave. I think addiction is one of several perplexing categories of human behavior that's perplexing to people witnessing it and deeply perplexing and distressing to the affected persons themselves. When we think about trying to explain human behavior that's perplexing, all of us, our minds, want to slide towards easy, simple explanations. And I think at the extremes of explaining those, there's philosophical systems that are voluntarist, which says, if you want to explain a human behavior, the person's will is sufficient to explain it. And people might appeal to compulsion or other factors that led to their behavior. But really, if you want to get down to brass tacks, the will is a sufficient explanatory factor. At the other extreme, we have determinism, which says, you know, this sense of free will or of any component of agency impacting the behavior is an illusion. We might think that, you know, the will is involved, but really it's not. Their behavior is predetermined by something else. Either, you know, ancient determinism said what happens to you is determined by the gods or the fates. And we in our time have this new sort of neurobiological determinism, but it's a determinism nonetheless that says your behavior is hardwired by your genes or the structures of your brain. You might have this illusion of being an agent or the will impacting your behavior, but that's actually not really a factor. So we encounter perplexing human behavior. When we want to explain it, we're always instinctively drawn to simple explanations. And these voluntarist determinist poles are the simple extremes that offer us simple explanations. I think we see with addiction a voluntarist and a determinist extreme offered to explain addictive behavior. And if you look at the debates around addiction in a variety of settings, political settings especially, but even academic clinical settings, we see a voluntarist explanation, which is often called the choice model of addiction, and a determinist explanation, which is often called the disease or the biological model of addiction, facing off against each other and people dividing themselves into camps and sort of endlessly battling over which of these is better. As is so often true when we, as Christians, look out at a landscape where there is this polarization, what we need to do is to step back, charitably evaluate those explanations, see the potential things we can learn from them, but try to humbly mediate between those extremes. I think when we look again at the perplexing behavior that all of us display, I think we can tell the truth that it's somewhere in the middle. The things that I do that, like St. Paul, that I just can't understand or that I really regret, it isn't only my will that's implicated in those things. But similarly, it would be wrong to say my will had nothing to do with it. And so some of the work of the book in explaining what I've called a personal model is trying to do the work to navigate that middle ground between choice and pure compulsion in a way that speaks precisely about persons with addiction and what's going on in their minds, but also speaks charitably, warmly, and respectfully about the truth that they're persons who God loves and for whom God became incarnate. So there's a lot more I could say, but I think the headline would be, most of the debates in our society are narrated somewhere between the choice and the disease model. Most people speak in the language of one or the other. One of my experiences working in medical settings is if you really get under the hood, most people instinctively know there's something missing from both of those models, but find it difficult intellectually to figure out how. Like, it's like Luther describes, sometimes you do theology, you're like the drunk man walking down the hall. You just only know how to move forward by hitting the walls. And it takes wisdom and careful work to know how to walk down the middle. And I think this is one of those cases where one of the big passions behind the book was to try to do the work to help people match their moral intuitions that something is wrong with both the poles and give them tools to know how to walk down the middle.
Yeah, we can come back to this later maybe too, but with these models, there's a tendency to medicalize addiction.
Yeah. Mm.
How have you seen that impact the way like Christians engage with either people with addiction in their families or their community or in the wider community? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was doing a seminar for some people who were pastors or about to become pastors. And because I'm an eMERGE doc in my bones, I like to do education through case discussion, which mm-hmm. is easier with physicians than it is with pastors. But I like just bringing some hard cases and saying, okay, if this happened to you, what would you do? And then using that as a grounds for conversation. So one of the cases that I brought to these persons was the case, you know, your pastor in a church has a family who you know really well, you have good trust with them, they're engaged in the church and they have a son who's in high school and you have a good relationship with him. You've noticed his behavior has changed over the past couple of months and his parents and him email you to ask if you can meet with them. And when you do that, they tell you together that he's basically become addicted to drugs, that through something he took one time at a party, mm-hmm. He and several of his friends have become addicted to some drugs that they are sourcing maybe from the downtown east side, they're not sure. And previously he was doing well at school, involved in sports and youth group, and now all of that stuff has fallen off. And the son is at times very resistant to any help, at times is just desperate to be free, but feels like he can't. And there's beginning to be, you know, some really troubling patterns, him stealing from his parents and those kinds of things. And they've already gone to an addictions clinic and a doctor recommended a prescription for a medication that he started taking, but hasn't produced a dramatic change to his pattern of drug use at all. And so they come to you as a pastor and ask, what should we do? And one of the things that I found striking was that most of the people in this seminar, their primary answer had to do with going back and talking to the doctor. And many of them offered, we would accompany them to go to the doctor. So it wasn't that they wanted to simply abandon them, but they implicitly saw addiction through the language of the disease model or the lens of the disease model and said, this is first and foremost a brain problem that is a medical problem. And therefore, the real solutions are to be sought in medical spaces. And my role as a pastor may be adjunctive to that, but really maybe not at the center of what the person needs. I think it's time for pastors, for churches, for Christian communities to think differently about addiction. Not in any way that's antagonistic towards good medical care. And obviously a big part of my professional life is trying to provide good medical care for persons with addiction. But the medical model in seeing addiction as only a problem of the brain misses most of the person. One of the opportunities I had in writing the book was just reading dozens and dozens of addiction memoirs. And I have yet to read a story of addiction where the solution is only found in a prescription or the advice of a doctor. Again, that doesn't mean that prescriptions and good medical advice are bad, because usually they're profoundly good. But if you ask people how they came to a place of healing, they talk about their mom, their brother, their religious faith and convictions, their having a child, falling in love, or finding healing from grief or trauma they've suffered in the past. These are whole person journeys that are not just journeys of the brain of neurons. They're journeys of the mind, the body of whole persons. And so I think that it's time for the church, again, not in any way in antagonism towards medical care, but being cheerful about the blessing of good medical care. But it's time for thick religious spaces, communities to step into the space of seeing ourselves as places that should be places of recovering and healing. Doing that requires a lot of growth for us. Requires a lot of work for us. But again, I think there's a tremendous opportunity for us, given that the harvest is plentiful of persons with addiction who are desperate for help in our communities. And so I think there's a beautiful, challenging opportunity here.
Yeah. You alluded to this before, but this whole idea of this then developing the personal model, calling a personal model. Can you explain a little bit more about that? Sort of you're saying it's trying to walk in this middle space and not bump against the walls in the same way. How does that change things for the person who's addicted, and then those who know them and are trying to support them.
So one of my premises, and this is the premise that I feel in my guts, as well as nicely with my mind, hopefully those things dovetail. But one of my premises is that I want to always be disciplined to speak about persons with addiction in a way that affirms that they are human persons who are not, because of their addiction, dramatically or morally different from anyone else. Mm-hmm. And some of my gut level beef with the choice and disease models is I perceive each of them to be placing that sort of potentially depersonalizing distance between me and the other that inhibits my ability to relate to them and to learn from them. Where the choice model often implies that they have an addiction because they're somehow degenerate or they're morally inferior. Mm. The disease model wants to do better, but often places just as much distance by saying that they have an agency-destroying brain disease that places their action outside of the realm of the ability of other persons to relate to them. I've had the real blessing of getting to know so many persons with severe addictions in my experience that they're persons like me. Not to overplay to say they're exactly like me or their experience is exactly like mine, but that I refuse to accept any model that says they have this condition simply because of degeneracy or neuropathology. I think it's much better to look with curiosity, with clarity, and with humility at the ways in which they are like me and they, at a base level, have a shared nature, shared desires, shared needs as myself. And so the core of the addiction model, or at least the nub from which I tried to grow this way of speaking, was this fundamental conviction that addiction is a phenomenon like many perplexing categories of human behavior that grows from things that are shared for all human persons. And so in very sort of brief terms, I describe in the book addiction as a form of ordering principle for a person's lives. All of us live our lives in accordance to certain rules or creeds. All of us have ordering principles by which we organize our day. In our society that is so individualistic, that tells people you have to make your own structure, it's understandable that there's a lot of people who are casting around looking for ordering principles by which to construct and prioritize different things in their lives. Mm. Addiction and addictive patterns of behavior offer people a powerful, clear way of pursuing purpose and meaning in their life. The best memoir, there's a great memoir that really emphasizes this. It's a heroin memoir by someone named Anne Marlowe that's called How to Stop Time. And she says in that book, she describes herself, she moved to New York in the 90s and was a very superficially successful person, but underneath that felt this pit of nihilism, despair, essentially. And it was in using heroin in like underground music clubs that she initially found a way to be connected to other people, connected to art and meaning and beauty. And she says in the book, people who aren't users often think it's bizarre how we use heroin to order our day and order our time. But really, they've got it the wrong way around. Using heroin as a way of looking for order. The base need is the common human need, her living in the city that never sleeps and having this sort of soulless job. The heroin was a way of providing order to her life. And she says, when I stopped using heroin, what bothered me most was my relapse into loneliness. And that's another one of these quotes that just really sticks with me from all the reading that I've done. Mm. Addictions offer persons ways of looking for the good things in life. This is one of the nuances to some of the common secular ways of narrating healing from addiction. One of the common mantras, and this comes from a journalist named Johan Harry, who did this very famous TED Talk. He concludes by saying, the opposite of addiction is connection, which is very powerful and in some ways is right. But the nuancing truth is that addiction is itself a connection, or at least it's a phenomenon that offers connections to the good things in life without ever delivering upon them. Connection in the abstract is not enough to replace or displace addiction. What we need in healing is the gradual process of displacing disordered or fruitless patterns of seeking the good with ordered and fruitful patterns of seeking the good. And I, again, want to use the word disordered without suggesting any culpability judgments on the persons who are affected. But I think we can speak truthfully by saying that addiction is a form of disordered love. It's seeking a belonging, connection, healing, peace through heroin, which will never ultimately deliver those things. And so healing from addiction is about seeking those good things that all of us want and need in more fruitful and, I think, ordered, to use sort of Augustinian language, places. There's some other things I say in the book. I talk about this behavioral category from Aristotle of incontinence. I know many of you will think of urine when I say incontinence. I'm not talking about urine in any way, but I'll maybe leave that to the side for now. But all that to say, I think there are some good things that we can learn from the disease and choice models and the motivations of people who pursue those models. And I'm convinced that this sort of personal model picks up some resources from Christian theology, from philosophy, to retain the good things that the shallow models want to say, without falling into the pitfalls of them.
Yeah, you've mentioned Augustine a couple of times. Are there Are there other sources in scripture and theology that have guided you in how you think about addiction?
Maybe to speak to scripture. When I first started teaching about addiction, I felt like I was more reliant on philosophical sources. And I had a few pastor friends who were always asking me, people asking me about the Bible, which I'm so grateful for. Some pastor friends who had people in their church who had severe addictions, who wanted to be able to go to the Bible with their sense of guilt and shame, with their hope, and how could they find things in the Bible as footholds for their journeys. And I initially found that to be a very challenging question. And in the intervening couple of years, as I've thought slowly about this, I've realized that some of my initial challenge was just because I wasn't listening to the things that the Bible was saying. And if we take the time to step back and humbly allow ourselves to be immersed in the strange world of the Bible, as Karl Barth would say, we find there not just, you know, abstract spiritual tidbits to help along the journey, but we really find the ground of our whole approach to persons with addiction. One example that I share in the book is the example of the story of Jesus and the Gerasene man. And I initially was biased against seeing the story as having to do with addiction, because I immediately thought that making any kind of connection would suggest implications, because this is a story about someone who has who's possessed by a demon, and that drawing any kind of connection would be seen as making assumptions about some relation between a demon possession and addiction. But it need not be so. What we encounter in the Gerasene man, who Jesus encounters, is a person in the world of the Bible of whom we would rightly say that he is acting in one way, and yet the source of his behavior comes from something else residing within his mind that compels him to act contrary to how he would act according to his true nature. Right. It is both him who is acting, and it is not him who is acting. It is something residing within his mind who is acting through. Again, we've already seen another example of this kind of behavior in St. Paul, right? Who says, it is not I who acts, but it is sin dwelling within me. This common human behavioral category of saying, on one hand, of course, it is me who was doing it. It is, of course, the Gerasene man who was shouting and screaming, and it was his blood that was bleeding when he was scratching himself with stones. And yet we feel deeply that there is an inhibiting, oppressive force within his person that is compelling him to act in this way. And so I think we can say that we can find a strong analogy between the Gerasene man and persons who have addictions, even if that analogy breaks down at some points. And right. We should be careful not to overplay the analogy. Mm. One thing we see then is we ask, how did the human community respond to the Gerasene man? Well, they cast him out. They stigmatized him in the strongest possible terms. We recognize that is often the responses of our communities. That is often the responses of churches to persons with severe addiction. And then we see in strong contrast the response of Christ to this person. And this is the only moment, if you look at the Gospel of Luke, for example, that Jesus asks a supplicant their name. This to me is unspeakably significant, that Jesus, prior to healing him, comes and looks at this man and says to him, what is your name? This man was suffering under the oppressive burden of something that was attacking his agency, his ability to behave according to his God-created nature. And yet Jesus addresses him as a dignified person, as an agent, asks him this incredibly personal question, what is your name? And the drama is only underscored when the demons answer instead of the man, revealing just how much he's been oppressed by this indwelling force. And we see, of course, the beautiful power of Christ to heal that man, but the stance of Christ towards the person, of seeing the person beneath the oppression, is a powerful example to all of us as we encounter persons with addiction. One final reflection on that story is that the Gerasene community is not happy about what Jesus does there. And we don't have it totally spelled out in the Gospel of Luke as to why, but I think one common reading is that they're upset about the loss of the pigs. For them, if there's something transactional here, their neighbor was healed, but the downside, so to speak, is that they lost a lot of capital, you know? It hurt the economy of the Gerasene region if this was a transaction in their mind. And for them, that exchange wasn't worth it. The investment of resources into the healing of their neighbor was not worth it. So often, our society thinks that way about persons with addiction. So often, our churches think that way about persons with addiction. The truth is that for persons with severe addictions, most of the time, their healing requires significant investment from their communities, investment of time and love, persons willing to sit with them, leave their phones on at night to be available to them, to share their living rooms, their spare bedrooms, and also at a societal level, financial investment in spaces of recovery. and healing. And so often, we, like the Gerasenes, aren't willing to invest what it takes to produce community or to produce recovery from addictions. And yet the example of Christ reveals a profoundly, dramatically different approach to the person. So that's just one example of how when we first go to the text, we might not see that story as a story that can speak to our and speak to addiction. Some of our cautions might be warranted because we want to be careful that not to overplay the analogy in a way that could respect could suggest disrespectful or presumptuous things about the persons involved. And yet, if we simply listen to what the story is saying, what this beautiful account from the life of Christ is saying, I think it suggests real, clear, pragmatic implications for how we interact with our neighbors and for medical people, our patients, our clients of addiction.
Yeah, you've started to get into this, people who've got their phones on and people who are willing to invest time and resources. And you're telling this story about the young person, the parents are saying, hey, we need help. And the pastor say, let's just go to the doctor. I wonder if you could talk maybe a little bit more about that for church leaders. Like, where does the rest of that story go when you're having that conversation with pastors? How do you then broaden out that, yes, we want to be caring well and being cheerful about medical intervention and then other ways of helping with healing and things? What advice do you give? How do you broaden that out to think about?
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
Like, in relation to that, I'm also wondering, like, you work in the Downtown East Side. There's a number of churches in the Downtown East Side and in Greater Vancouver, I think, in general, everyone's aware of the situation, but there's a sense of like, well, you know, you give money to UGM or you support in this way. Other than that, you know, we're not experts.
You'd rather like not meddle in it and kind of like, let's let the people who know what they're doing do what they should be doing.
Yeah. So yeah, what do you think of?
There's so much we could say. The lamest answer is that the third section of the book is really dedicated to this question of addiction in the life of the church. I do think on some narrow questions that there is merit to letting people who have certain kinds of expertise participate in certain kinds of care. So UGM is a wonderful organization, and their recovery program, their ability to do some things extend beyond what, you know, expertise that we should expect every pastor to have. And so I think it's okay to say that. At the same time, though, I think if we believe that addiction is fundamentally similar to many problems that human persons have, and that the path of healing from addiction has much in common with many forms of sanctification in our lives, then we should see churches as places that should be at the center of healing journeys from addiction. Doing so will require changes to the way that we organize many of our churches. So one of the things I mentioned in the book, in the beginning of Acts, it describes the church as people who met together every day. I think sometimes we read that and we think that's because they were some kind of superheroes, or they didn't have jobs, or like they never doubted anything. They were superheroes of the faith. But I wonder if some of the reason they met every day is because they were weak and because they needed encouragement from each other, or they were afraid of persecution. They were persons just like us. They were tempted to disordered loves. The witness of, for example, 12-step programs reveals that the power of communities, of primary social identification, and of opportunities for daily belonging. So I think that that's one thing that is vital for churches and for pastors to consider. Maybe a year ago, I was teaching on addiction in a church, and there was this young man who came up to talk to me after, and he told me he wasn't a Christian and that he came because his neighbor invited him. And he told me that he had an addiction to cocaine. And he said, I'm starting to realize that I have a problem. But he told me he really loved the talk. And he said, you know, sort of cheekily, I was really loving the talk. So I snuck out to have a bump of cocaine in the lobby so I could really focus. But I mean, what a beautiful thing it is that someone in a place like that would feel welcome in a church to come back. You know, even though acknowledging himself to have a problem, he didn't see a religious community as looking down on him or setting themselves apart from him, but rather felt that he could, even in that space, come back. But he and I had a good and a very warm chat, and he said he wasn't quite ready yet, but when he was ready to stop, he would come back. And I often think about that. And it pours hot coals on my head in terms of the conviction of what our church will have to offer a young man like that when he comes. Again, the harvest is plentiful, but are the laborers prepared? That young man doesn't just need a once a week religious service. Even offering a meeting or two with a pastor or a mentor once a month, that isn't enough. His existing social relationships are ordered around use of cocaine. The ways he looks for meaning, focus, concentration, purpose, feeling confident and like himself. Cocaine is the vehicle by which he pursues those goods. And so he needs a whole new space of primary social identification. He needs new friends who know not just this guy who uses cocaine, but who know about his family, his siblings, yeah. where he comes from, what he likes, who take the time to get to know him. And so mm-hmm. I think that I would really want to cheerfully push back if a person who's a pastor of a church in Vancouver says, we can just leave the addiction stuff to UGM. I would say, yes, praise the Lord for UGM. Bless them for what they're doing. But also to that pastor, you have men in your church who are addicted to pornography. You have persons in your church who have hidden alcohol addictions that mm-hmm. you don't know about, and all kinds of other addictions that may be visible or invisible. If we believe that the church is the body of Christ, and the body of Christ is the place where people can find healing, right worship, freedom from oppressive idolatry, then we need to pick up the responsibility. And that calls us to a whole bunch of challenging, costly, self-emptying disciplines. But also we can have good hope. Because addiction isn't fundamentally a degeneracy problem or a pathology problem, because it's a personal problem, then we can have hope in the practices of the church. Again, alongside good medical care, alongside narrow expertise of particular organizations, we can have hope of the practices yeah. of the church to produce healing.
Yeah, and you said the harvest is plentiful, but the workers need to be prepared. Yeah. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those who are preparing for pastoral ministry. So there's the pastor in the church that's already got an established congregation, and to try and think about how they structure that church. How do you think about the preparation of pastors and ministers, and what do they need? I mean, this conversation.
Yeah. I would really encourage, and again, I'm not a pastor, so there's many people who have more expertise in this than I do. I would really encourage persons who are thinking about this, open themselves up to being present in spaces where they can pursue friendships with persons who are very different than them, including persons who have addictions. And my family, my kids and I on Monday nights go to Jacob's Well, which is a friendship center in the downtown East Side. The model of Jacob's Well is not that people come from other places to volunteer, but it's a community of friends. Mm. And some of the friends who attend Jacob's Well live in the downtown East Side. And some of them have now or have had very severe addictions in the past. Some of the friends who come to Jacob's Well live in other neighborhoods in Vancouver. But we come to share in a space of mutual affection, mutual learning. And from attending there regularly for a year and a half now, like me and my kids, we have dear, dear friends who live on Hastings, and then people who we care about and know their, not just their names, but we know their stories. And that lies underneath all of the work that I do at St. Paul's, or the teaching I do about addiction, is this core commitment of the value of the persons. Even just one other story, this is a St. Paul's story, but there's a young man, we'll call him Eric for the sake of this story, who I've seen many times. He's got a severe opioid addiction, and I've seen him for overdoses and for infectious disease complications of his addiction many, many times. I know him quite well. And he, fairly recently, his dad died. His dad also had a severe addiction, and all his dad had to pass on to Eric. He told me his dad gave me his predisposition to addiction. But other than that, all his dad handed down to him was two $1 bills. That was his inheritance from 1973. And shortly before his dad died, he said, these are for luck. And basically that was all his dad had to give him by way of inheritance or legacy. And since his dad died, Eric's been using in more dangerous ways. His sense of his hold on life is loosening and spiraling out of control. And we've seen him at St. Paul's more. And I find myself, when I go to work, looking at his chart because I'm scared that he's died. You know, every time I'm gone for work for a few days, I worry about him. And recently, he came to St. Paul's, and I bought him breakfast. I was sitting while he was eating his breakfast, and he pulled out, he said he wanted to give me something, and he pulled out of his bag and he gave me a $1 bill. He said, I want someone else to have one of these long as I'm around. We can each carry one of them to think of each other, and so that someone will remember me if and when I'm gone. And that obviously is incredibly moving to me. But again, it's a reminder that my stance to Eric, yes, I'm a physician, and yes, he's a patient, but like, we're both persons. Both of us can give and receive generosity to one another. Both of us can learn from each other. And so the first thing I would say, if someone's a pastor or wanting to be a pastor or a chaplain or an outreach worker or a counselor, a person with addiction, for Christians, the first thing to really lean into is what it means to have mutual relationships with those kinds of persons. And so I would invest in places like Jacob's Well, places where you can go and build mutual relationships with people who are different from you, and see that as the ground floor of any other work. you do, even when you find yourself, of course, in my vocation, I have expert, non-expert relationships with my patients. There's like asymmetry to those relationships. That's not bad. It's good when used humbly. But I want to start from that place of mutuality. Again, there's so many other things I could say, but yeah, that's a primary thought anyway.
Yeah, it's a good thought.
Yeah, and thinking about, you know, the limits of mutuality and for people very, very close to people with addictions, caring for them. Like, I think you referenced Beautiful Boy in the book that you've written. I saw the movie, I haven't read the book, but just watching your child struggle with an addiction and how much do you give? When do you draw a line to care for yourself? If there's someone listening who, like this is a real, you know, live issue, what advice would you give?
The first thing I would just say is to that person is just bless you, that the Lord is the one who sees and who knows, who hears your silent, desperate prayers in the night. The Lord is the one who knows that every time your phone rings, that there's a part of you that's just petrified, that it could be the phone call that your child has overdosed or something terrible has happened to them. If you feel as that parent or spouse or family member that you just carry around with you this this invisible weight of terror or guilt that you did something to cause it. One of the horrible things about that feeling is it can be invisible to others. But the Lord sees and knows and is tender to you in that. This is one of the areas in my learning to speak about this issue where I've made many mistakes. And in my trying to call the church to a high standard of self-emptying hospitality, I at times have been inadequately attentive to those parents, those spouses, those persons who desperately want to help, but who don't know where their loved one is or have realized through many tries that having that person in their home isn't a stable pathway to freedom, and that person needs a different environment, maybe more structure, more accountability. And so I, even while I would say that our ethic is the ethic of Christ, the ethic of Philippians 2, of true costly self-emptying, we should as a church be carefully, compassionately, gently attentive to those other persons, those silent sufferers who are affected by the addictions of others. And I think as Beautiful Boy attests and many other stories, memoirs from loved ones of persons with addiction, sometimes a wise and prudent response to a person with addiction involves creation of certain kinds of accountability structures. Some people might call those boundaries, in order to try to promote engagement in certain kinds of spaces that produce a recovery. And I do think for persons with severe addiction, severe substance addictions, often the just go home and stay with my parents model doesn't work for probably a variety of reasons. And that isn't any failure of the love of the parents or the care of the parents. But again, I want the church to be a place where people don't have to carry around those burdens in a silent or invisible way. And one of the things we haven't said yet, but is so important to say, is that churches too often can feel like places where people try to put on their best faces, and where discussion of those deep wounds is tacitly discouraged. Some of the power of 12-step models is that AA especially is narrated in terms of shared frailty and shared need. You don't go in as the person whose last drink was yesterday and hear the person whose last drink was 30 years ago saying, "I'm great, I'm a hero." They start by saying, "I'm an alcoholic." And lots of people in medical communities roll their eyes at that kind of narration. But psychologically, that's incredibly powerful, that everyone around this circle is grounded in a shared confession. I'm frail. I'm susceptible to making mistakes and to falling back into patterns of compulsive behavior. The church should be a place that narrates our lives in the same way, because we should be a place that begins by saying, "I'm frail. I'm a sinner. I'm in need of grace and compassion." And I've given up the project of culpability judgments, of saying it's not really my fault. Again, the whole like voluntarism, determinism, justifying myself, how much is it someone else's fault versus my fault that I'm broken. Simply, as a truth, I need saving. And as long as our churches don't lead with that, they won't feel like places of refuge for persons with addiction, or especially for their families. And so I do think that, again, this suggests a call to us to be communities that narrate our lives in terms of our need for one another, our need for God, and our shared woundedness. We're not all wounded in the same ways, but I would love the church to be a place, that parent, you know, like the parent in Beautiful Boy. I feel this in my work. I feel increasingly this tenderness towards parents who come in with their children who have addiction. And I feel like for the first few years of my practice, I didn't see them. I just saw the addicted person themselves and felt a responsibility to them. And now I always try to take a moment to look at those people in the eye and say some version of thank you and bless you, and to acknowledge how hard it is to sit beside their child in an emergency department in a context like that. And I think the church can be a place of blessing to those people, blessing in practicing presence with them, compassion, but also real steely discernment about when you change the locks or when you make that hard decision to set some accountability boundary. Those things aren't outside the bounds of Christian wisdom. But it obviously takes a lot of careful discernment to land on those things.
We had a question here, which I was hesitant to ask, around sin, confession and repentance. I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to. But as you were just talking now about this importance of coming and admitting our shared frailty and our shared brokenness, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how you think about sin, confession, repentance for the addicted person, but also for churches and communities.
I think we are often, for good reason, very cautious about talking about the theological category of sin alongside the behavioral category of addiction, because we are appropriately worried that to speak of sin may sound like you're making culpability judgments about the person. Right. So to narrate a certain behavior and saying it's sinful can sound to our contemporary ears like you're saying it's their fault.
Right.
And if sin means that, then we indeed should be very cautious and even angry about people who narrate addiction in simple categories of sinful choices or something. And I cared for a patient once who became addicted to opioids because her mother injected her when she was 12 and I say this in quotes, but as a reward, is the way her mother narrated it, for behaving well or doing chores or something like that. And that young woman went on to have a very severe addiction to opioids and to die of an overdose on the downtown east side. We should be deeply morally indignant at someone who looks at that person and says, oh, they just live this kind of life because they were sinful. And again, so the caution is really appropriate. I think it's really important when we think about the theological category of sin to see that there are, when we try to ask the question of what sin is, there are also voluntarist and determinist extremes that are unhelpful in, or at least insufficiently nuanced in narrating what especially for Augustine, the category of sin means. So at the voluntarist extreme is like, this is wrapped up in the Pelagian heresy, this idea that like the fall is only a matter of will. And therefore, if we will enough, we can will our way to perfection. And that has rightly been denounced by the Mother Church as a heresy, because sin is not just a matter of the will choosing wrongly. Sin is a matter of our wounded nature. It's of the drives that precede choice. And so we cannot be free of the bondage of sin through our will alone. We need Christ. We need the grace of God. And sin is not a voluntarist concept. Neither is it a determinist concept. And if you look, you know, in the ancient or the early church, this is part of the Manichaean heresy that says maybe we have some degree of free will, but really human beings are the vessels through whom cosmic good and evil forces work through us. So sin isn't really a matter of our will at all. It's just the outworking of other higher beings acting through us. So when we talk about sin, there are, similar to the categories of addiction, voluntarist and determinist extremes that are insufficiently nuanced to describe what sin is. I think once we let go of the culpability judgments and we say sin is a way of narrating that which mars our right relationship with God, our right relationship with ourselves and other persons, and our right relationship to the created order and to the natural world, then we can see the way that what we say about addiction doesn't fall outside the things that Christians have always said about the common dilemma of human persons and our common need for saving. The thing that I would say to churches is that understanding this actually is a key step to displaying meaningful hospitality to persons with addiction. It can sound like such a downer to sort of turn to the sin conversation. But one of the reasons that persons with addictions often feel outside of, like out of place in the church, is that they feel like they have an additional moral problem. They walk into the church and they say, here's all these good religious people. And yeah, maybe they're sinners, but I have this extra problem called addiction. But if we, again, can be more like 12-step communities and can narrate our religious life, our shared social life, in the common confession, I'm a sinner. I cannot save myself. I'm in need of the grace of God, and I'm in need of the grace of my neighbors. And if that confession is taken to include and subsume anything that any kind of addictive behavior, then we can recognize one another, persons who have severe addictions and persons who don't, as having at the deepest level a common problem, which at the highest level has a common solution. It doesn't mean the approach is pastorally exactly the same. One story that I find really helpful in illustrating this, I go to a Mennonite Brethren church, but I also call myself a Christmas and Easter Catholic because I love going to Mass at Christmas and Easter. And I took my daughter to Mass on Christmas Eve, what's now almost 2 years ago. And we went to the big Catholic Basilica downtown. And for the midnight Mass, we got there an hour early and it was packed. Mm. It was awesome. And we got a seat because I had a child with me. But we were sitting there and by 11:15, it was standing room only. But we entertained ourselves by watching. When people came in the door, there were these two ushers, these two young men, and they were awesome because when someone came in who needed a seat, a pregnant woman, a person using a walker, a variety of things, they had no qualms. They would just walk up and down and just boot people out and make them stand at the back to make space for the person who needed the seat more. And so me and my daughter were watching them and I was selfishly feeling very glad that I brought my daughter because I knew it would save me from their eyes. But right before the Mass started, the doors opened at the back of the Basilica and this lady came in who smelled very strongly of alcohol. And she came and she dropped a bottle on the floor. So everyone turned around because it made this loud clanking noise. And I turned around and I recognized her as someone who is a reasonably common St. Paul's emergency department person who comes in for being drunk. And she was apologizing loudly and sort of socially inappropriate compared to this hushed religious context. And I'll always love the ushers for this because they didn't hesitate for a moment. They booted someone from their chairs and went and greeted her and just guided her to a seat with warmth and with the same deference that they showed to anybody else who they felt needed a seat. And as you probably know, near the beginning of the Catholic Mass, there's a confession of sin. I confess to you, God, and to my brothers and sisters that I have sinned, and what I have done and what I have left undone. And as we were praying this, I turned and I looked at her, and I was stumbling through the words, because again, I'm only a regular Catholic. But she was praying them fluently and just weeping, and her face was like shining, and she was smiling. At the risk of overinterpretation, she looked filled with joy at being in this setting on Christmas Eve. I think many people outside the faith would look at confession of sin in someone like that and see it as just a kind of self-flagellation. You have this already person who's already suffering, who's already grieved, and you're just telling her to confess sin as if it's like a further kind of insult or shame. But it struck me at that moment that when paired with hospitality, refuge, and belonging, confession of sin was a beautiful way of leveling the playing field, of saying what was true. She was equally ready to celebrate the Mass to anybody else because she had done all that we need to do to be prepared to celebrate Christmas, which is to confess ourselves to be in need of the saving that takes place at the Incarnation. And so she didn't have an additional problem. There was nothing additional holding her back from the celebrating of the Mass compared to those around her. And so narrating addiction carefully in terms of the things that Christians have always said about our sinful and broken nature can actually be a way of helping our communities be places of refuge and mutuality, telling the truth that persons with addiction do not have an additional moral problem to the rest of us. And that is good news because then the journey of sanctification for them and for all of us shares the most important things in common. Again, allowing for the nuance that doesn't mean the pastoral or medical or other kinds of approaches are exactly the same.
Yeah. As we finish here, alongside J-Term, you're teaching a class next summer. You're going to be teaching a class in the Downtown East Side. Could you share a bit about what you're thinking about for that class, what it might look like?
Yeah, this is the class that will take place in June. It's called Learning in the Downtown East Side. This is a class that has been present at Region over the years in several different iterations. So I'm very humbled, grateful to have the opportunity of teaching this course and stewarding something that I think has been a really beautiful experience for many Region students over the years. The goal of this class is to learn together in the Downtown East Side. And so very little of this course will take place at Region, so very different, and a very small amount of this course will just be, you know, Quentin talking about my opinions about these issues. I'm really grateful to have good relationships with a number of organizations that work in the Downtown East Side that are already doing the good work, and so the goal is to go into the Downtown East Side to meet the persons who are learning there, both persons who have lived in the downtown east side, have had addictions or those things themselves, but also persons who are called there vocationally. I would say this is less focused on addiction narrowly, mm-hmm. And more broadly, we'll do some learning about the history of the downtown east side and think about social justice, anthropology a little bit, alongside, of course, the unique challenges of the downtown east side that include the issues related to addiction. So we'll talk to folks from UGM. We'll talk to people from Jacob's Well. We'll do a little bit of St. Paul's stuff as well, and some churches in the downtown east side, chaplains, those kinds of things. So I've heard that it's been a really impactful course for students before. I'm really grateful to hopefully just be a facilitator of connections between students and so many people who have been struggling, hoping there for a long time. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, Quentin, we have laughed, we've cried, we've listened intently, and it's been such a rich conversation. Hopefully this has just whet people's appetite to join you in January. But thanks for your time, and thanks, as always, for your compassionate presence. Thanks.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Regent College podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, I'd really encourage you to share this episode with a friend. And if you really liked it, then we would love you to go to your podcast provider and write us a review and rate the podcast so that we can reach even more people with the conversations that we're having here at the Regent College podcast. Thanks.